This is the second half of O'Brien's two-day speech. This part is entitled Security, Sanity, and Fair Play. And the reason why I'm doing this, for whoever has ears to hear, your government is gone. They've been gone arguably since, certainly after World War II, and before that, started to disappear little by little. I mean, we once had statesmen. I think there were some at least out there. Now forget it. And that's the reason why politicians have a dirty word, and yet these idiots go out there all the time stumping for their guy just because he's a Democrat or a Republican. And the same stuff happens all the time, and nothing goes anywhere. The stuff that the other candidate does, they hate. If it were their guy, they'd love it. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's moronic. And here we are, sinking slowly but steadily, and everybody's worried about which party holds sway. You know, the lesser two evils is still evil. Thank you. This is O'Brien. In the preceding chapter, we attempted to describe where we are on the loyalty security front and how we got there. For many of us, it is a sordid and discouraging picture. We are especially concerned with the steady and, in a way, logical expansion of governmental procedures with increasing disregard for the traditional liberties of the citizen. As shown in the outline of the successive statutes, executive orders, and so on dealing with the National Security Program, this new and strange policy has been established one step at a time until it now stands out as a coherent pattern of a legal system in startling contrast with the distinctive features of the tradition of fair play as well as Anglo-American constitutionalism. There is no necessity for criticizing the integrity of purpose with which the governmental policies have been established and administered, nor for attributing evil motives to our officials. Expediency has ever been the enemy of freedom. It is the policies that are wrong, regardless of the conscientious purposes of their defenders. It is an old and inexorable law known to all students of government administration that, in practice, once a bureau is established, it is all but impossible to get rid of it. The same law applies to regulations and procedures. Once established, they inevitably show a tendency both to expansion and to permanence, and they illustrate Mr. Justice Cardozo's comment about the inevitable tendency of a principle to expand itself to the limit of logic. One has only to look back to the situation in 1947 when the first loyalty program was promulgated to realize how steadily the aims and procedures which characterized that program have expanded in scope and also expanded into one field after another in the operations of government. This growth also illustrates the subtle and insidious way in which what appear to be slight aberrations of procedure grow into major invasions of constitutional freedom. As Mr. Justice Brandeis once observed, quote, and here we go again, the greatest dangers to liberty lurk in insidious encroachments by men of zeal, well-meaning but without understanding. And that also comes from the court case Olmstead versus U.S. in 1928. Once the government undertakes to regulate any field, it seemingly always becomes necessary for it to reach out and regulate other fields. How true this is in the field of ideas must be apparent to every serious-minded observer. We obviously could not, if we would, now secure the abolition of the numerous bureaus and officials who administer these programs. And going back, if you remember what I had said about the book by William Z. Foster, Towards Soviet America, that's exactly what took place, and he laughingly looked at us Americans who would get all up in arms if you said, well, we're socializing the government or we are Sovietizing the government. But if you're increasing the federal government, that's okay. So federalization is okay. But the point is that in 1932, in answer to the problem of the Depression, we got heavily socialized, probably the most that we had suffered since the Civil War. But there is another side to the picture which should give reasonable ground for optimism. Experience dictates that a relatively small group of determined men could bring about modifications in the procedures already established for dealing with loyalty questions and make them accord with our traditional rules of fair play. After all, the English Petition of Right was the work of a limited group of this type, and the addition of the Bill of Rights to our Constitution was the work of relatively few leaders, and for themselves, which is something that O'Brien could not have known. The gravest fault in the present system is not the attempt to provide adequate security, but rather in the failure to appraise more accurately the extent of the danger and then to test proposed measures of security by the yardstick of long-established guarantees of the freedom of the individual. The answer to the problem is not necessarily the abolition of security programs, but a drastic revision by men soundly educated in the history of freedom and in the history of constitutionalism. Before enlarging on this view, I should like once more to point out the more conspicuous governmental developments which seem to provide unmistakable evidence of an expanding trend of policies at variance with the American conception of fair play. The establishment in our jurisprudence of the doctrine imputing guilt because of associations, conferring upon administrative officials the right to investigate and pass upon the character of opinions entertained by an individual and upon his rights under the First and Fourteenth Amendments, adjudging men to be untrustworthy, not because of wrongful acts, but because of their ideas, because of motives attributed to them, or because of suspicion as to their future conduct. The promulgation by the Attorney General of lists of organizations thought to be subversive in the use of these lists in determining qualifications for employment, the use of secret information contributed by anonymous accusers, the denial of the right of cross-examination to the accused person, the lack of any constitutional protection which might be given through judicial review, the supervision and limitation of the freedom of travel by American citizens, the participation of military officials in many decisions affecting the guarantees of the Bill of Rights, the interference with the right of a citizen to work in a defense plant or American ships, the establishment of security officers and of hearing panels in all governmental agencies drawn exclusively from governmental personnel and operating without any central supervision or determination of uniform procedures. And there is a footnote to this. It appeared in an article, Science and Security, in the American Academy of Political and Social Science. That periodical, 1955, by Livingston, from whom we've heard before. And here's the quote, the footnote. A more basic question, which is frequently neglected, involves the philosophy and purpose of the security program. What is the security program intended to achieve? Can we agree on the meaning of the words we use in defining this purpose, such as security and loyalty? Or can we define reasonable bounds for the areas in which secrecy is required? What kind of security procedures are best for this country? How can we make the most progress toward our acknowledged goal of world peace? All right, just to interject at this point, I respect O'Brien for the message he was trying to bring to the people. But there seems to be a bit of a contradiction. At least this is what I find. In that he points out what might be unreasonable practices, prohibitions, proscriptions placed against Americans who are under some kind of scrutiny. But then he gets all wound up about communism, and my point is, if we're talking about the values here that O'Brien is upholding, then if the Communist Party, let's say, gains traction and the people want it, isn't that what you're supposed to allow to have happen? So in a sense, what I'm getting is that O'Brien is saying that these impingements upon personal freedom and such is dependent upon exactly what kind of ideas you have. Like, we'll support your right to have that idea, but maybe not that idea. Okay, so I think there's a problem here, but it's part of the human psyche. I mean, it's not just O'Brien, you know. It's the old bit about what I find in America all the time with all these constitution huggers who believe in the right of freedom of expression. But if you go ahead and advance something that they're not in agreement with, or it's controversial, or it's unpopular, they want to censor you. And I do this in the United States all the time. You know, someone who does it, well, you have the right, yeah, but when I don't like what you're saying, you don't have the right. So don't give me this crap about the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights. All right, moving right along. These then are the innovations and the new restraints affecting the American society that at least many of these innovations in some degree invade or threaten invasion of the constitutional liberties of the citizen does not seem to admit of doubt. The vital question is whether all these measures are made necessary by the character or the extent of the communist danger in this country. Here we go. Assuming, as we do, that some system is necessary to protect the security of the nation, is it necessary for the most powerful and the most civilized nation known to history to disregard, and perhaps discard, the principles of individual freedom which have been successfully maintained for nearly 300 years and which are given special sanctity in the Bill of Rights. The danger is fully apparent, but the problem is to determine the extent of the danger and whether it cannot now be adequately met by traditional procedures consonant with the constitutional guarantees. Attempts are sometimes made to justify these restraints as necessary to prevent sabotage and espionage. How many times have we heard those two words? But affirmative evidence casts some doubt on this plausible excuse. In World War I, after America entered the war, there were no instances in which sabotage was proven. The same is true of World War II. There's a footnote there. This comes from an article, Modern Arms and Free Men, by Vannevar Bush, 1949. The absence of real subversive effort was in fact surprising. Even conventional sabotage for stopping the wheels of industry was almost non-existent. Part of the credit belonged to the FBI. Still, there was more than this. The great democracies had become less vulnerable to that particular form of mischief. And that is the end of that footnote. All right, the same is true of World War II, and after 3 years' administration of the original loyalty order, as I have pointed out, Chairman Richardson testified that not a single instance of sabotage or espionage has been shown in the hundreds of cases which have been reviewed by the Loyalty Review Board. As far as espionage is concerned, it is obvious that none of the programs or regulations would have prevented the treachery of Fuchs, the Rosenbergs, or real communists of that ilk. All the multitudinous restraints we have discussed must therefore be justified, if at all, on the theory that they are necessary to prevent the spread of ideas thought to be inimical to the national safety. Of course, the fact that communist propaganda is intrinsically of the most dangerous character must never be forgotten. For communism in operation is a power different and far more potent than any organized political force. Its activities are directed by a hostile foreign power, and in all aspects it is characterized by what Reinhold Niebuhr has called, quote, the noxious demonry of this worldwide secular religion, end of quote. And that is from Why is Communism, written by him. It appeared in Christian Realism and Political Problems, 1953. But the real question that confronts us at this moment is not the character of communism, but to what extent this poisonous propaganda has succeeded in affecting our people. It is a pertinent fact commonly overlooked by historians that since the Genet incident in the administration of President John Adams, foreign propaganda aimed at persuasion has never been successful in winning the favor of public opinion in this country. Those of us in touch with such matters estimated that during the early years of World War I, the German government expended in propaganda within the United States upwards of $35 million for the purpose of cultivating a sympathetic interest in the cause of the Central Powers. The effort was a total failure. In addition, Count von Rintelen, in whose prosecution I was a participant, that meant O'Brien, wasted more than $500,000 in vain attempts to create anti-war propaganda within American labor unions. Whether the imperviousness to foreign propaganda be due to the native shrewdness or skepticism of the average citizen, or to his innate distrust of foreign political ideologies, the fact that none of these efforts has ever been successful to any noticeable extent is of great importance in appraising the extent of the present danger of the Soviet threat to our institutions. That the effectiveness of communist propaganda has been grossly exaggerated, and there is, as of today, much less danger than is commonly supposed, appears now to have been definitely confirmed by recent investigations. First of all, it is important to note the assessment of the present menace of communism, which has been made by the American people themselves. In his recent book, Communism, Conformity, and Civil Liberties, Samuel A. Stauffer summarizes the results of two separate nationwide polls of public opinion. Whether the results of such polls are generally regarded with skepticism or with confidence, the facts found by Professor Stauffer cannot be disregarded. His book contains convincing evidence that at the present time, the American people are not concerned about the internal communist threat. They are aware of grave dangers, but there seems to be complete confidence that the situation can be managed satisfactorily without drastic changes in our national way of life. This reflects, incidentally, their unquestioning confidence in the work of the police and government intelligence agencies. It is also interesting to see where the American public believe the danger lies. Is there, for example, a widespread belief that our country is now crawling with communist spies and saboteurs? Professor Stauffer's clear-cut answer is no. To the extent that they are worried at all about the internal threat, the American people seem more worried about the possible conversion of fellow citizens to the communist ideology than about the criminal activities of enemy agents. In the Stauffer survey, less than 1% of those of the general public interviewed volunteered any concern either about the internal communist threat or the threat to civil liberties. Of the community leaders interviewed, only 5% volunteered concern about either of these issues. This does not mean that Americans are indifferent to the issues of communism or civil liberties. It does mean that the communist danger is no longer directly felt as a personal threat by Americans, and that relatively few citizens have experienced any sense of threat to their freedom from that source. Only 3% had ever known and admitted communist, and these respondents were disposed to be tolerant. In short, and contrary to widespread belief, the country is not now in the grip of hysteria or of emotional fear of communism. Assuming that these results are typical of the American people generally, they certainly indicate that the general public today is far less disturbed than are the politicians, so many of whom exploit the communist issue sensationally and for selfish purposes. And the results of the Stauffer survey also indicate that our people are not in the least worried about communistic activities that would constitute any real threat to the maintenance of our institutions. Professor Stauffer points out, however, that there is much loose thinking about what some aspects of the communist ideology really mean. A frighteningly large number of our people use the word communist recklessly to describe to describe anyone unorthodox enough to question the existence of God, or who suggests that the railroads of this country should be operated by the government, or that there should be a leveling out of economic class distinctions. Gee, doesn't that sound familiar? During and after World War I, the word Bolshevik was used just as widely and indiscriminately under similar conditions. Now, just understand that a lot of children in school, whether it be in grammar school or gone on to college, more and more think socialism is the way to go because they see what you might call, shall we say, the inequalities in, I guess, the classes, if you will, and how, you know, of course, they've heard nothing but the eroding middle class. Well, the middle class is gone. All right, so that's it. However, because of all that's gone on, they feel socialism is the way to go. So here we are. If this country was bent on trying to prevent that kind of thinking, they certainly did a bad job. And, of course, one of the ways they could have prevented that thinking by having capitalism be more beneficial to more people. I mean, the point is this: in capitalism, it all sounds great, but there's more, far more losers than there are winners. I mean, the whole idea is competition. I get that. But, of course, if you're getting into a competition, one wants to win. One, only one, and the rest are losers. So how does that go eventually across decades in the century? Back to O'Brien. This inaccuracy in the current use of the label communist goes far to explain why some Americans have exaggerated the susceptibility of their fellow citizens to communist ideals. If we adopt the popular use of the term communist for those whose views we dislike, there are no doubt a great many loyal American citizens who must be included within that infamous category, and doubtless many more will be added in the future. But if all the American people could know and discuss all the implications of communist ideology, it seems reasonable to expect that they would revise their estimate of the present communist threat and conclude that in 1955 there is little danger that the ideology will spread further in the United States. Surely, in view of the hostile and shattering publicity which has been directed at communist theory and technique in recent years, there cannot be more than a maladjusted handful who will actually surrender their souls to the Soviet cause in the future. In the opinion of the American people, at least, the danger of possible espionage and sabotage certainly should not be the cause of any particular alarm. To some of us, there is not only little danger of further contagion, there are also marked indications that the tide of communism in this country is steadily sinking and that this has been true for some time. There is nothing new in the attempt of special groups to promulgate ideas subversive of our national government. Conspicuous instances of such activities occurred in 1798, in 1812, during the Civil War, during the anarchist agitation of the late 1880s, during the IWW agitations, and throughout the period of World War I. However, with the sole exception of the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, in no other instance was any attempt made to establish peacetime governmental policy aimed at the control of ideas thought to be subversive. There have been occasions, as with the suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War, when under the stress of dire emergency, certain guarantees of civil rights were ignored, and during the Second World War, by executive order of the President, afterward confirmed by an act of Congress, 80,000 citizens of Japanese ancestry were deprived of their rights and imprisoned, one of the greatest outrages in our history. But these instances were not typical, and until the last few years, it might have been truthfully said that the protection of constitutional rights in the field of personal liberty was being steadily maintained both with the support of public opinion and also in the judgments of our courts. As of today, obviously, this is not true in relation to governmental policy. It is one of the tragic ironies that after a period in which the courts, by new interpretations, have greatly liberalized the constitutional restraints upon government officials in the field of economics, at the same time they have been acquiescing in the expansion of the power of the government in placing restraints on the liberties of the citizen. You know, this is all well and good, and when O'Brien says that the instances of such egregious practices against American citizens is not typical. Okay, I get that. I understand it's not typical, but it doesn't make a difference. The fact is that when it is introduced, a new threat, the same stuff goes on. It's like I said before about human behavior. Oh, do you learn by remembering history? No, you don't. Because every time this comes up, people act in the same way. The same buttons are pushed, and they all run, like the masses that they are, the herd, in one direction. So it doesn't make a difference if these interjected events are atypical. As soon as they come up, they gain traction, and people start going in that direction about, yeah, give us security, do whatever you have to do. Every time you've seen somebody with a microphone stuck in front of their mouth about some kind of threat, what do you hear? Oh, I don't care what they do, just as long as they keep us secure. So we're back in the same situation again.
Carl, this is really too much.
It doesn't make a difference if it's communist, if it's Muslim, whatever it should be. You introduce the boogeyman, and everybody does the same thing they did in every single decade or century where it happened before. Dressed up differently, same old, same old. It is a historical fact of special significance that the guarantees embodied in the Bill of Rights did not have their origin at one time or in some code. Most of those relating to due process of law and aimed especially to ensure fair trials originated one by one in rulings made by common law judges. It is a fact of even greater significance that these and other guarantees were created to protect the individual against just such pressures as confront us today. Some of them were created for the special purpose of protecting him against the same reason of state, which are being asserted today to justify secret evidence, anonymous accusers, secret hearings, and so on. And yet that's exactly what we've got right now. See something, say something. You could go ahead and ruin somebody's life in the name of seeing something and saying something. And it's the same thing as what happened back then. Because as we get further and further into fascism, what rises up is a snitch state. You got fascism, you'll have snitches. It's a network that will prosper by turning other people in, whether or not there's anything that anybody would turn anybody in for. You know, it's in the eyes of what? The snitch. It is a fact of utmost significance that the Supreme Court has established the First Amendment in a preferred position above all other provisions of the Bill of Rights. Historically, it is definitely established that the guarantees protecting the liberties of the citizen, which they embodied, were in essence originally the result of religious conviction. As Dean Pound and many other commentators have emphasized, there was in the 17th century a natural affinity between the Puritan principles of morality and the common law. Many of these principles were distinctly of religious origin and were taken over and embodied in the common law. Not only was this true, but the fateful English revolutions of 1640 and 1688 were successful because of the advocacy of these guarantees of liberty by the common law lawyers of that era. One outcome of those revolutions was the embodiment of these guarantees in the unwritten Constitution of England. Entirely in part from the early history of the influence of religious conviction on the development of common law, the effect of the same influence in New England has been both powerful and permanent. This fact has long escaped adequate notice. The recent studies of Professor Rossiter, of Professor Miller, and others have now definitely shown that in the colonies, the religious convictions of the individual, constantly encouraged by the pressure of ministerial exhortation, had a powerful and lasting effect in establishing American principles of law and later of constitutionalism. Furthermore, as often pointed out, colonists regarded education as the process of cultivating virtue. The essential basis of these principles were those of the common moralities, and they still remain, giving a moral content to the Bill of Rights. Please don't make me puke. Upon reviewing all the policies and procedures affecting the mental attitudes of citizens, it cannot well be denied that our governmental officials have embarked on a fatuous policy, which in effect is aiming to guide and constrain citizens as well as aliens in the exercise of liberties guaranteed to them by the First Amendment and the other provisions of the Bill of Rights. One convincing evidence of this intention is found in the endeavor, through procedures by the State Department and the Bureau of Immigration, to build a wall around the nation in the futile hope of preventing the spread in this country of foreign ideas or ideologies. For the implications and effect of regulations such as these go far beyond the exclusion of dangerous spies or saboteurs. But here's the problem. You build a wall around your nation not to let in unfettered immigration. It's not the ideas. The ideas don't need a door to go through, all right? The ideas are in the air. The ideas are everywhere. I mean, you have communications, and you don't have to be inside a certain nation. The problem is that when you want to reduce terrorism by telling people that you have your troops fighting elsewhere to keep you safer here, and then you let people from belligerent nations, as they deem them, to come in.
Hello? Hello? Anybody home?
Are you serious? No country is under any kind of order that they have to allow in immigrants. No, that's just not the way it goes. Every country has a right to do what it wants to with regard to immigration. You take a nation like New Zealand, I don't think Jesus could get in right now. But that's got to do with the sovereignty of the country. You don't have to let anybody in just because they want to get in. And as it was in the 50s with the bad old communists, if you did have agents from the Soviet Union in here, you let them in the front door. Now, they may have come in here under the guise of being emissaries, whatever. But the point is that you let them in. If you think that's a problem, if you think that they might be contributing to some kind of undermining of the country, you get them out. You don't let them in to begin with. Same thing now. You're allowing in people who may be belligerents.
Don't make a bit of sense to me. If that's what being crazy is, then I'm senseless, out of it, gone down the road, wacko. But no more, no less.
So anyway, I'll leave it at that right now. We're in the second half of the two-part speech of John O'Brien, given at Harvard in 1955. And this second half is entitled Security, Sanity, and Fair Play. And one other thing I had said I would like to put up, and I will put up, a multi-part series I did on the book, The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America, from 1981, in which the author, Leonard Peikoff, foresees the United States going fascist. You know, we have become what we hated. And that's going to be up now, also companion to what I'm doing here, all part of the Alembic Files. We thank you for listening, and we hope that you stay with us. Thank you.